Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. For years, New Mexico has languished at or near the bottom nationally for child well-being. And one factor behind that ranking is our high rate of child abuse. In the last few years, we have seen horrific stories of children severely injured or killed through abuse. Many of those cases come through the Child Abuse Response Team, or CART, at the University of New Mexico Hospital. The staff do exams to diagnose abuse. They also work with social workers and law enforcement and serve as expert witnesses in legal cases involving child abuse and neglect. My guest today is Dr. Leslie Strickler, medical director for CART. She's the only board-certified child abuse pediatrician in the state. And just a quick warning, we will be talking about some disturbing issues in this episode. So if you're with young children, you may want to listen at another time through our website. Dr. Strickler, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get interested in diagnosing child abuse?
My interest originated from my days of residency training here at UNM. I had come from medical school in Chicago, where I thought I had seen a lot of variety and was very surprised to come to New Mexico, where we stand as UNM Children's Hospital as the only trauma center for children in the state. And what really amazed me was the volume of pediatric trauma we saw, and particularly abusive trauma, given the relatively small patient population we have. So that's what got me started in the field, and I recognized as a trainee there weren't a lot of other physicians who dedicated their time and expertise to caring for these really vulnerable patients. So I identified mentorship as a trainee, and then as a faculty member joined CART as a consultant. New Mexico is a fascinating place to learn medicine, and I came with no frame of reference. What first amazed me was realizing how big the state really is. And I remember being an intern in our pediatric intensive care unit and looking at our giant map of the state on the wall as children were transferred in from tiny towns that I'd never heard of before. What also amazed me is how critically ill and hurt so many of them were. And how far they had to travel for adequate care, and how hard it was to protect them in our legal and civil system.
Why do you think there aren't more doctors who are focused on this?
There are a lot of reasons, one of which is that it's a challenging topic. I think people assume physicians are well-equipped to handle with a variety of challenging situations, but in reality, even doctors find this very difficult, and most people have visceral reactions to child abuse, so that's the number one deterrent. Beyond that, it takes quite a bit of extensive training to become a board-certified child abuse pediatrician. Currently, that requires 10 years of training, including 4 years of medical school, 3 years of a pediatric residency, followed by 3 years of a child abuse fellowship. We tend to come out of training and land in academic medical centers, which tend to be the lower-paying sites for medicine. So because we have extensive time requirements of training and relatively low reimbursement with people coming out of medical school with hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt, we just haven't done well in recruiting people to the field.
Where does the child abuse response team enter the process?
We receive referrals either from other healthcare professionals who are caring for children who have injuries that are concerning to them for possibly being due to child abuse or neglect. And we also take referrals from protective services and law enforcement. So any of those professional entities who are tasked with responding to a concern of abuse or neglect can refer children to us for a medical assessment.
Are you pretty much the go-to place that people are?
Yes.
Bringing children? Okay.
CART is the only medical consult service in the state of New Mexico geared at looking into concerns of physical abuse and neglect.
So even if they're 3 hours away, 4 hours away, five, they might come through CART.
They may, but one of our challenges is the fact that it's difficult for children in communities remote from Albuquerque to get here to receive care. So what we know is there's a disparity in care for kids outside of the metropolitan area because there aren't doctors like me in those areas to provide the care. And the primary care providers in those areas face a lot of challenges in providing the care. They don't often feel confident in their level of knowledge about doing the assessments. The assessments are very time consuming. They're not well reimbursed by medical insurance. And as we've discussed, they're just tough to handle.
Have you utilized the Project Echo model at all to extend your expertise? Does that work?
We're hoping to.
Okay.
And that's part of our legislative initiative being presented in this year's session, is partnering with Echo to develop a telehealth program that's geared at training primary care providers out in the rural communities in the field of child abuse, to give them the knowledge they need and the confidence they need to be able to care for kids when appropriate in their communities.
What is involved in diagnosing whether a child has been abused?
I always first answer that question by stating that I do the same things other doctors do, because I think our field does generate a lot of confusion and that sometimes people assume we're investigative and we're not. When I see a child, the first thing that I do is I review their general health history, so I understand how that may play into any injury that they have. I also review what's called a presenting history or history of injury. That may be done with a child's parent if the child's an infant and can't speak, or the child's so critically injured that they can't speak. But in older children, I'll review that injury with them. I do a full physical exam. We pay very close attention to the skin, because a number of the injuries that we identify in cases of abuse are on the skin. I also then order any additional studies that I think are necessary to help me evaluate my patient, so either to identify injuries or help me interpret injuries or health. So that could be blood work. It could be imaging studies such as x-rays or scans. Sometimes I enlist the help of other specialists to care for my children, which again makes it important for me to be in the university setting. A lot of our assessments rely on the quality of a history provided to us, but also on our knowledge as physicians of injury mechanics and of child development. That's actually a really important concept of what we do. We have to be able to match a history with the developmental capacity of a child, and especially how mobile is that child? How coordinated are they? Should they be able to engage in whatever activity it is that was presented as causative of their injuries?
And if the child is in a position to actually talk with you about what happened, like how does... Talk about that process. How does that work?
It's pretty simple. Kids are often the best historians that we have in medicine. I take great care to ensure that when we have been asked to see a child, that a child who's verbal feels that they're in a safe space to speak about themselves. So one of our policies in our outpatient clinic is that if a child is referred to me for an assessment, that child cannot be accompanied by an alleged perpetrator of abuse or even a parent or guardian who's not necessarily protective of the child. Obviously, that's important for safety and liability, but it also ensures, again, that kids know that they're in a safe place where they can talk freely about their lives. And I ask open-ended narrative questions to children, and it's very simple as I examine them. If I see injuries, I simply ask them what happened. And you'd be amazed at what they'll tell you.
Well, I know a lot of times kids, though, have been told, don't tell anyone, right? Depending on what happened.
Yes, that's not uncommon. And it's actually more common in the realm of child sexual abuse, where part of the grooming is to instruct children on what to say or what not to say. It's less typical in cases of physical abuse, although what we commonly recognize in cases where children don't feel that they can speak is that they actually want to be protective of the perpetrator of their abuse, because it's typically someone that's close to them and someone that they love. And they recognize by speaking up that that will be disruptive to their family, that that will get someone they love in trouble, and that it may even get them in more trouble. So there are a lot of factors that children are having to consider when they're in these situations. And at times we have to acknowledge that and empathize with them. But for the most part, my experience in physical abuse cases is that children are fairly straightforward with telling you about what has happened to them.
What about sexual abuse? Do you also handle that?
Yes. Our sexual abuse program is called the Para Los Niños program, and it's based at the Albuquerque Family Advocacy Center downtown. So a separate physical space and staff where we care for children in whom there's concern of sexual abuse, assault, or exploitation. Those assessments are actually uniquely different from physical abuse assessments, because typically concern for sexual abuse is based on a disclosure of a child that something has happened to them, but they will have a normal physical exam. There won't be any physical evidence on their body in most cases that something has happened to them. In physical abuse, the case is the opposite. Typically, what occurs is a child comes to care with some injury that's either significant or not well explained by the history provided. So it's, in a way, a game of opposites.
Why is it important to have experts in this process, in addition to other medical professionals? You talked about how long it takes to get to be board certified in this.
The truth is that we have a very narrow margin for error. And I say that meaning it's important for us to get it right when we do these assessments. And I think what most people think of is the fact that when kids are being abused, if we cannot identify that and step in and protect them, it's well established that their abuse will continue, and the tendency is for it to worsen over time, so risking that child's long-term well-being and even life. On the flip side of that, being investigated for child abuse is very traumatic to a child and to a family. And we, in my field, recognize that any opportunity that I have to interpret an injury where I can say, you know what, this is all okay, allows me to help de-escalate a traumatic process for a family and unnecessary interventions. And believe me, it's a much better day when I can come out of a case and say, you know what, this is all okay. I'm going to call CYFD and let them know. I'm going to call law enforcement and let them know, and your life is going to get back to normal. That's also important because it can help redirect our ever-scarce resources to the places it needs to be.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking with Dr. Leslie Strickler. She's the medical director with the Child Abuse Response Team at UNM and the only board-certified child abuse pediatrician in the state of New Mexico.
How are doctors trained in recognizing possible abuse?
Hopefully, during their training days. Again, my experience as a medical student was I never saw a case of child abuse in Chicago because I didn't happen to work at a trauma hospital. I never got a lecture about child abuse. I came to New Mexico, and thankfully we had child abuse specialists here, so I started to learn about them, about the cases in my clinical rotations, and I got some lectures about that. So it really typically lives in the hands of the larger academic medical centers to teach students and to teach training physicians. We also do a fair amount of outreach to the community as we can, but one of our challenges, again, is because we're such a small field, we have limited time to do this. So we have to hope that in people's early training days, they get some exposure. And then for individuals who go into, say, primary care emergency medicine, then the onus is really on them to seek additional medical training. And that's not easy to do, particularly in a state like New Mexico, where there's one specialist. So oftentimes, providers would have to go out of state to national conferences. And that's not always an easy feat either. When we are overwhelmed by volumes of information we need to maintain, particularly in primary care.
I guess I'm shocked that you were never lectured or anything about child abuse. Do you think it's typical of physicians going through training?
I think that was more typical, and I'm going to date myself now, 20 years ago when I was in medical school. There's been substantial growth of my field since that time. And again, I think it was a bit reflective of the training environment that I came from that was much more community-based and not in a large academic center. So I don't think that was everyone's experience, but I think that experience was much more common than that it is now.
Can you give an example of a case, obviously not letting any sensitive information about identities, but walk us through how you concluded child abuse happened in a case?
Sure. I think the cases are best categorized as, sadly, the easy ones, where you don't have to be a child abuse specialist to recognize that a child's been abused. And those tend to be the cases that are high profile and people learn about in the media. Those are cases where coming in the door, for instance, to the emergency department, a child has external signs that clearly indicate they've been beaten, multiple bruises or cuts, numerous broken bones, sometimes in older children who will tell us exactly what has happened to them. In those cases, the role of the child abuse pediatrician really becomes documentation. You know, meticulous documentation is my role. I ensure that I do a thorough interview with that child, and I ensure that I direct all of the high-level care that they need to identify all the injuries that they have. The other cases, which are more intellectually challenging, are the subtle presentations, the nuanced cases, young infants who maybe have one injury that's not well explained and then require additional workup to determine, do they have other injuries that maybe we can't see on physical examination? Do they have a medical condition that might have made them at risk to get an injury? Those are the cases that I think a child abuse pediatrician becomes most important. And we do focus directing our care to the pre-mobile, pre-verbal population because those are the children at higher risk for abuse and who are hardest to sort out because they can't walk in and tell you what's happening in their home.
How do you know when you're right?
My answer is if you have to either know you're right or be able to say you don't know. And it's not always a black and white situation. There are three potential outcomes of our cases. We may make a diagnosis of abuse or neglect. We may definitively rule out abuse or neglect. And about 10 to 15% of the time, the reality is that by medical assessment alone, we may not be able to make that determination. There may be a scenario which I feel needs additional investigation, say at a scene or at a home. So I think what's most important is not necessarily knowing when you're right, but knowing when you can't be definitive. Because again, our margin for error is very slim. And in those cases that might fall into that gray zone medically, what I'll typically do is give a narrative summary of my impressions of the case and where I think the risk lies for the child and what additional information could be gathered to increase certainty of a case or be more assured of that child's safety. So one thing that's unique about our field is we really do have to collaborate closely with multiple different stakeholders, not all of whom are other medical professionals. And that's what's really different about me. I spend more time talking to law enforcement and protective services than any of my colleagues. And I spend more time doing that than I do talking to other healthcare professionals, because they often bring information to the table that I may not have access to as a doctor that may really inform our assessments.
Have you ever had a case where it seemed that you decided, it's unclear if abuse has occurred, but later on something happens and it
became... Yeah, and those are the ones you never forget. They're not common, thankfully, but and usually those are cases, again, where we can't make a definitive medical diagnosis and we make very specific recommendations about what to look for in the home. And I'll freely acknowledge, I think there are cases where those kids have fallen through cracks, which is reflective of the problems in our system. There are also cases, admittedly, where an injury truly is so nonspecific. For instance, a toddler, say, reportedly falling and breaking their wrist. It's a very common injury. There are cases where some way we just don't have a way to know, and we have to acknowledge that, and time will tell. It's just gut-wrenching when time tells you that the child really wasn't safe.
So given you're a small staff, you're the only board-certified pediatrician specializing in child abuse, and with instances like that, how do you manage your own emotional stress?
That's a good one. You have to compartmentalize, and I look at child abuse as a pediatric disease process, which I think is not how most other providers look at it. But for me, it's what allows me to get my hands in there every day, do the work, take care of the kids, and take care of myself. I acknowledge that it happens, and it's something we need to respond to. And my take on it is, if we turn our heads from it and we don't help children in need, we're not helping solve the problem. And I think too many people take that approach. They just prefer to ignore it and hope it will go away, and when in reality, it doesn't. So you have to face it head on, but you also have to leave your work at work. And so for me, much like I think any other professional, I draw those lines. And when I leave the hospital, I engage in other activities that are fun and meaningful for me, and try and take time off as well when I can, which is hard when you don't have a big team.
Because you're a mom, too.
Oh, yeah.
So that must hit home.
It does. I think the transition to becoming a mother was particularly challenging, especially when I would see age-matched patients. But it was, again, something that I worked through. And I will say, becoming a parent also added to my ability to empathize with other parents in difficult situations. And when we look at the families we care for, where there's risk for maltreatment in the home environment, these are families facing substantial adversity. It was very humbling for me to become a parent with all of the resources and support that I have, and recognize, man, this is hard. How hard would it be if I had to stress every day about putting food on the table, whether my utility bills will be paid, whether my partner is going to hurt me, whether I'm focused on getting another hit from whatever substance I'm addicted to. You know, these are the issues that many of our children's families are facing. And when you put that on top of just the general stress of parenting, it amazes me we don't see more child adversity.
Do you think there are misunderstandings or myths about child abuse we hold in society?
There are in the legal community, because some of these cases are very hotly contended in the criminal courts, but I think that's kind of its own unique little world. I don't know that I would call it myths, but I think the concept of denialism is more apparent in the feeling that this won't happen to me, this won't happen to my family. Most people, again, react very strongly and negatively when they see cases of child abuse in the news. But it's not uncommon for the families directly affected to go through a process that includes anger and denial about what is happening. And I think that's actually a fairly expected emotional reaction, but it can make it difficult, again, to work with families when you, as the child abuse pediatrician who's really acting for the safety of that child, becomes viewed as the villain, you know, to a family. That's not a fun place to be.
Yeah. How many cases does the child abuse response team see each year?
On average, we see 300 to 350 in person, and we do case reviews or assessments of some sort in another 200 to 300. Last year, we saw almost 400 kids. I think that was our busiest year.
it's almost your busiest year. Anecdotally, do you feel like abuse rates have gone up in the state?
I don't know that we have yet accurately tallied the abuse rates in our state. What we know, and this is all based on CYFD reporting, which doesn't cover tribal jurisdictions, so one important note to make, but over the last 10 years, the number of reports to CYFD has dramatically increased. The number of investigations they have done has increased, and I'm talking from difference from maybe 30,000 to almost 40,000 referrals, and the number of substantiated investigations has increased. As a child abuse pediatrician and being the only provider in the state, the volume of patients I see and diagnose is really most limited by my availability and resources. So there's a finite amount of care that we can provide that I don't think is a good indicator of rates of maltreatment in the state. What I know is that we're not giving care to nearly enough children. My personal feeling, based on my experience here, is that much of maltreatment is never reported, and that's not unique to New Mexico. So I just don't think that we have clearly assessed what the volume is, and I actually think it's a positive thing that we're seeing more reporting and more substantiations, and I think it's a bit of an opposite perspective that many people have. But again, to me, it tells me we're doing a better job of recognizing what's happening in our communities.
CYFD doesn't count numbers in tribal communities, but you see patients from tribal communities, I'm assuming.
Oh, yes, we do. Again, okay. We take referrals from tribal social services, tribal law enforcement. I mean, that's a very complicated system because Native American lands are sovereign entities. And in New Mexico, we have over 20 different tribes and pueblos. And so they all have their own law enforcement and tribal social services. They're not networked together, and they tend to be relatively small and somewhat under-resourced too. So we get a lower number of referrals from them because they reflect a lower population, but we certainly do work with them closely. And as it's well known that many of our Native American children face the same, if not greater, rates of child adversity than other children in the state and the nation.
If you just tuned in, this is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. I'm talking with Dr. Leslie Strickler. She's the medical director with the Child Abuse Response Team at the University of New Mexico. She's also the only board-certified child abuse pediatrician in the state of New Mexico. How long does it take to see a patient?
Our appointment times are quite long, and that's what's unique about us. We spend a lot of time with a small number of patients. Our minimum clinic visit length is 1 hour. Sometimes we spend up to 3 hours with patients in the outpatient clinic. If I'm seeing a child who's hospitalized, that's half of a day. And sometimes that's just the bedside information gathering. I may have to review volumes of medical records, extensive tests. Sometimes our consultations take up to 6 hours to complete.
So in a for-profit medical system, that's not really going to work.
Yeah, we're not making anybody any money.
And how much time is spent beyond that working with like law enforcement, going to legal proceedings?
Countless hours. And I would even add the time we spent documenting our consultations isn't counted as part of our direct patient care. And in general, for every hour I spend seeing a patient, I spend another hour on documentation. Our notes are often 10 to 20 page, single spaced lengthy reports and MBs, and we release them as we're required to protective services and law enforcement. But we spend a lot of time discussing our cases with protective services, law enforcement, attorneys assigned to cases, because these aren't healthcare professionals and these are very complicated assessments. So we have to do a lot of education, not just with other healthcare providers, but other professionals who don't have medical background. And that can be even more challenging to assure that they're understanding what a child's injuries are and why it's been determined that the child's been abused. And collaborative efforts, though, are incredibly important because that's what it takes to keep kids safe. So we have to dedicate time to do that.
There has been an effort for several years to create a child maltreatment center at the University of New Mexico. And this year, again, there's a push for funding. So what is this and why is it needed?
Historically, because we're not a moneymaker, it's been difficult for the hospital and the Department of Pediatrics alone to subsidize our service. And what that has meant is that we have to rely on support from other entities. So all of my clinical support staff at CART are individuals who have primary appointments in other places or to do other things, and they've agreed to utilize part of their time to support us.
So they're not full-time with you?
No.
I see.
So, for instance, our social worker, who is really the glue that holds our team together, wears many other hats. But she does our patient triage, gets our patients scheduled, meets with families as she can. And what we really need is to have dedicated clinical administrative support positions to help us with our patients to better meet their care needs. And one of the most important patient populations to me is actually the children who come in because there's risk in their environment but haven't been abused or neglected in that moment, but we recognize this is a family that needs help. We are currently not poised to provide wraparound services to those families or even to help connect them to the services they need, and I'd like to see that change. So that's why we're asking for funding to dedicate additional clinical positions, so other people to do what I do, but also supportive staff who are dedicated to the program and can spend all of their time and effort caring for our families.
And how much are you seeking at the legislature this year?
Well, we're part of a joint effort with an ECHO program, as mm-hmm. well as the ADOBE program, which is a clinical program geared at supportive services for incarcerated youth, so more of a prevention program. But for CART, we're asking for not quite $700,000, primarily directed at supporting salaries for staff and clinicians to man the team, because again, the Health Sciences Center, based on the revenue that we make, would be in a pretty difficult financial position to subsidize that alone. And my perspective is this, the work that we do is at the mandate of the state. So we're uniquely poised to partner with the state, because what we're doing is, again, supporting child welfare and supporting investigations that the state has a requirement to proceed with. So that's part of why we have directed our ask to the legislature.
What's interesting is you're responding to need after things have happened, but I'm hearing you saying there's potential to go more upstream and prevent child abuse.
I would love to be able to do more of that. I mean, I don't think that anybody in my position doesn't look at that as a need, but we're also overwhelmed with caring for the acute, critically injured cases and assuring intervention where it's necessary, that I think we're all relieved to move past the cases again that at that time weren't abuse and neglect. At CART, about 50% of the kids that we see will not leave a consultation with a diagnosis of abuse and neglect. It's a pretty significant majority, but there's always a reason that those kids were referred. And oftentimes, those reasons are linked to risk in the home environment. So I think we are best poised to provide prevention services, not as primary prevention targeted at the whole population, but recognizing that we're getting a fairly sizable referral base of kids who haven't been abused but are at risk for that, and what can we do better to meet the needs of those children and families?
If we could have a larger sort of coordinated child maltreatment center, what impact do you think that could have on abuse rates?
Ultimately, everyone's goal is to reduce rates of child maltreatment and neglect. Again, I think we are still in the upswing in our state of recognition. Mm. So my initial goals would be to encourage the healthcare system to better recognize abuse and neglect. And that may immediately result in increased rates of reporting and increased rates of identification. And if that means we're getting accurate numbers, that's okay. That's what I want to see. The ultimate goal, obviously, is to make this a better place for kids to live. But to me, that's a lifetime and career goal, not a tomorrow or this year goal, because as we all know, our kids face a lot of adversity.
Thank you so much for coming and talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Dr. Leslie Strickler, Medical Director with the Child Abuse Response Team at the University of New Mexico. You can find all our episodes of University Showcase online at kunm.org. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.